Hello, this is Space Kate, and I'm continuing my space nomad adventure across the US. And today I've entered a new state and I've come to the Infinity Center, which is at just by Stennis, which is one of the NASA centers where, in fact, it's the largest rocket testing facility in the United States, as I understand it. And I've come to this really shiny new, I'm not sure if it's a museum or an education center or something.
All of the above.
All of the above. And standing with me is a chap called John Crouch, who I've just bumped into. And he's one of the volunteers here. It's his first day. And he worked on Skylab and the Apollo program, which is incredible. So I want to know everything.
Okay.
Let's start at the beginning.
A little bit on the shuttle and on the Hubble Space Telescope, and a little bit on missions to the outer planets. So where would you like to start?
Let's start with the one that everybody knows about, Apollo. How were you involved in the Apollo program?
Well, in 1964, I came to the Apollo program as a flight mechanic specialist from the Minuteman Intercontinental Ballistic Missile program, mainly because they needed flight mechanic specialists, and there weren't very many around at the time. I was 23 years old.
Wow. So you were around, I mean, I heard that quite a lot of the people working on Apollo were quite
young. Yes.
What was the atmosphere like? You know, did you realize the gravity of the work that you were doing? No pun intended.
Everybody was trying to figure out what to do and how to do it and develop tools to do it, because we didn't have any of that. We were going to do something different, because as we use men on these things, we were going to be trying to get a launch vehicle, a rocket, launched over a period of several hours. And with every minute in those hours, the way you flew the vehicle had to change. And so we were trying to come up with ways to express it to the computer, and equations to put into the computer to make it fly, and ways to target it, to find the end conditions to fly to. And there wasn't much out there. I mean, it was kind of develop it as you go, and that's what we did. We developed it as we went.
And you're talking about computers there, but we have to remember this is the 1960s, and the kind of computers that you had back then, I mean, I'm talking into an iPhone here, and I can send this immediately up to the internet, and, you know, in the blink of an eye. You didn't have that kind of technology back then.
We didn't. We had digital computers. Now, a digital computer with all of its various components might take up the size of a large room, and therefore it was slow, because the speed of a computer is inversely related to its size. So we were slow, but we were good. You know, and the precision that we needed was available. And we used computers all the time. Except one time on Apollo 17, when we were getting ready to make the last mid-course correction to crash a stage into the moon, and the computers were down.
So what did you do?
We had a backup plan, and we used it, and we hit the target.
But we always hear that with NASA. We always have the backup plan, always have the redundancies in place.
I wouldn't say they always did, but we did.
And from Apollo, you also worked on Skylab. Now, Skylab was it was actually just a section of one of the enormous Saturn V rockets, the third stage, I believe, and they made it into like a lab, and it was kind of like the first sort of space station.
It was a combination. Right? It was an empty third stage, and it was also a solar observatory. So you had a fairly large solar observatory that could be focused on the sun, look at the sun all the time, and then you had attached to that a rocket stage about the size of about a 50-foot trailer, double wide, double deep, which is pretty good size.
and
the whole thing weighed about 100 tons.
Wow.
So the Saturn V first two stages put this 100-ton spacecraft into orbit. We put it into an orbit that was 270 nautical miles up, and from there, crews were ferried up and spent 30, 60, 90 days up there doing experiments. It was our first space station.
And how did you get it back down, or did you just leave it up there?
Nature took care of that. you may not think there is any kind of atmosphere up there, but there are a few molecules of air and other gases floating around up there. And over a period of 6 years, it gradually decayed. And it finally came back down into the atmosphere, spread a lot of pieces all over Australia and the Pacific Ocean. And I don't, fortunately, it didn't kill anybody, but
lots of shooting stars, though.
It came down.
Wow. And you weren't actually based here at Stennis, though, were you?
I was at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville. I worked for the former Germans that we brought over. Dr. von Braun, Dr. Geisler. Dr. Geisler headed up the Science and Engineering Aeroastrodynamic Laboratory. They were responsible for flight mechanics. And I reported as a Boeing person and an engineer and engineering supervisor to people at the Aeroastrodynamics Laboratory. And they reported to Dr. Ed Geisler, who was one of the German Peenemünde scientists, and he reported to Dr. von Braun. So when we determined how to fly the various rockets, we would prepare documentation. It would go to them. They would run whatever checks they liked, put a cover letter on it. Dr. Geisler would sign it off, and it would be sent out to the world. So when Walter Cronkite came on and said, at such and such a time, this rocket will be so and so high, flying at X thousand miles an hour, those were our numbers.
How do you feel when you hear your numbers being quoted on the news with the whole world watching?
Very proud.
Ever nervous?
No, not really. Not really. Well, we did the job well. And we developed guidance and targeting information to put into the launch vehicle guidance system. And then we simulated the flight using that guidance and targeting information. And it always demonstrated that we were right. And so then we published that and computer data tapes, and that's how it went out to the world.
Wow.
And then we flew it.
I think a lot has probably changed at NASA over the years. You know, from the Apollo program, you don't have quite as much money. Maybe fewer younger people working there than perhaps there were in Apollo days, or not necessarily trusted with quite the same level of things that you were doing. I've heard, we're sort of looking at some of the commercial partners at the moment, like SpaceX. I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that, because I've heard people kind of compare the way that SpaceX is doing things with the way that you guys did stuff with Apollo. You know, a lot of young people just trying out some new stuff and kind of being left to get on with it.
Well, you know, I really don't know about SpaceX, but I've been impressed with what they have done. And there were a number of people that were concerned about switching the manned boost program into orbit to a private contractor. And my personal feeling is I don't see any problem. It is a mature industry. And there's no reason why it could not be done. In fact, they're going to do it. I think it's a good idea. What they're working on now at NASA is a heavy lift launch vehicle. And it will have a little bit more lifting capability than the Saturn V. Not a lot more, just a little bit more. But what isn't perhaps widely recognized now is that when they go sending men off to Mars, they're probably going to have to launch more than one module into Earth orbit, connect them up in Earth orbit, and then fly them out from there. So instead of launching one Saturn V equivalent, you might launch three or four.
Now that sounds like some launches that would be worth coming out to see.
They'll be big.
And you actually saw a Saturn V launch, I assume.
I saw the Apollo 11 launch. It was a beautiful day. 9:32 in the morning, daylight savings time, July 16, and it was blue sky with a little wisp of white up there. And you know, when they lit the candle on that thing, well, first of all, you see the rocket ignite, but you don't hear it. We were 4 miles away on the causeway, and 4 miles is 20,000 feet. It takes a few seconds for the sound to rumble through the earth, and when that happens, you get an earthquake under your feet. But it takes a little longer than that for the sound to get to you, and it's actually lifting off before the sound gets to you. And when the sound gets to you, it starts pushing against your chest, and you know, you're just shaking and it's hard to stand up. And that's at 4 miles distance. But
I was lucky enough to see a shuttle launch, and I was at, I think, 3.1 miles distance. And yeah, you see the thing beginning to launch, and you're so excited about it launching that you don't realize there's no sound. And then you start hearing the rumble, and you're like, oh, sound, yes. And you're right. I mean, even with a shuttle, which is, right, you know, not as powerful as a Saturn V, but you could feel that against your chest. But I just can't imagine what it must have been like to see it and Apollo.
Just a little bit more. And, you know,
I heard it broke windows.
Well,
the vibrations,
if you had windows to break, it could. I mean, you know, we flew in from Huntsville. I went down there with some Marshall Space Flight Center people, and we got on a plane, a private chartered airliner in Huntsville at about midnight. And they flew us down to Daytona Beach, and we got on some school buses, and they drove us down the coast into the North Gate at Kennedy, and we parked there. And literally watched the sun come up. I mean, when we got there, you had launch vehicles standing up and spotlights all over it. I mean, it was one of those really statuesque type things. And then the sun comes up and you get daylight, and by the time it actually flew, well, it was mid-morning, but it was impressive.
Now, when I came over to talk to you, you were standing by this kind of big shiny chunk of metal, which has scrap on the side of it, which seems a bit sad.
Well,
but you said it was interesting, so I'd like to know, what is this?
It really isn't scrap. This is part of the main combustion chamber of the space shuttle main engine.
Oh. Now, that's definitely not scrap.
Definitely. Well, it may be extra, and there may have been a destroyed engine at some point. But this engine is now being called the RS-25D.
Catchy.
Make much sense, except that it's going to be on the first stage of the new heavy launch system.
That's the
SLS. Space Launch System. And there will be several of these, four or five, I'm not sure how many on there. And they will be this size. And you will have pushed into here very hot gases that are then mixed in here. And they will burn in this area here. But as they burn, they are looking for a way out.
Right.
They are not traveling terribly fast yet.
Mm-hmm.
But they go out that way because there's a hole down there.
Mm-hmm.
And this hole right here is called the throat, THROAT, mm-hmm, throat. And as the gas flows to that throat, it speeds up. And at that throat, it goes to the speed of sound based upon its temperature. Speed of sound is temperature based. On the other side of that, it expands and goes supersonic. And it's got a big nozzle that expands it out, causes the speed of the gas to get very, very fast.
Mm-hmm.
And so this gives a great deal of momentum to the gas going out. And because action, for each action, there's an opposite reaction, the gas going that way at high speed causes the rocket to go that way, up.
Yeah. And the space shuttle had three of these. You're saying maybe five or six?
That's
pretty powerful.
Right. Five, I think, is the number they're looking at.
And here at Stennis, they do a lot of engine testing. And I went on the little bus tour from the centre here, and you can see some of these enormous structures.
Yes.
Why do they have to be so big? What are they doing to these engines?
Well, they want to make sure that the engines don't fly away, obviously.
Yeah.
Okay. And at Stennis, Space shuttle main engines were tested both individually and sometimes tested in threesomes. Now, if you took three of these space shuttle main engines and you fired them all together, you would get roughly the thrust of one Saturn V engine. The heavy launch system will make the difference by using big solid boosters. But the Saturn V had five liquid-fueled engines. And that big engine out front out there is one of those F1 engines.
Those really are huge. And the one here, I like it because it's just down low enough that you can kind of stand and gape into it, and it's huge.
That's right.
It's huge. Great echo if you put your head in and talk, by the way.
It has a rated thrust at sea level, 1.522 million pounds.
I actually can't conceive that. So
put five of them together, you get 7.6 million pounds, and that's at sea level.
And they said that they would test all five of those F1 engines at the same time, doing a cluster test.
And that'll look the biggest.
So how do you stop? I mean, with that much, what are you going to strap them down to the ground and hold them there as tightly as you can? I mean, how do you stop them springing off and breaking?
You tie it down to a test stand that weighs more than twice the weight that it can lift.
Hence it being so big. There we go. I've managed to answer my own question there.
There you go.
Wow. So this is your first day here at the center. What do you make of it so far, and why should people come and visit?
Well, I think it's a wonderful effort to give people an opportunity to stop in and refresh themselves on what's happening in space. In most cases, you have to go somewhere special, but right here on I-10, people passing by can stop in, spend 2 or 3 hours, have an excellent adventure, catch up on space, and then go on their way.
Certainly beats stopping at a gas station and grabbing a soggy sandwich.
There you go.
Well, thank you ever so much for spending some time talking to me this afternoon. It's been an absolute delight.
Me.
Thank you.
And I hope you have a wonderful time.
Thank
Where are you from?